Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Robert Kennedy was born 75 years ago this week. To mark that event, we've decided to take a look at Kennedy's enduring image as an American hero. How much of it is based on the historical record? How much of it is myth? We'll be talking to Ronald Steele, author of a new book on Robert Kennedy, In Love with Night, The American Romance with Robert Kennedy. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. Among the many factors historians identify as leading to World War II, the peace treaty of World War I is one of the most commonly cited. During this week in 1919, the United States Senate, by a vote of 55-39, rejected ratification of the Treaty of Versailles. The treaty's drafting, which was carried out largely by the leaders of the United States, Great Britain, France, and Italy, was marred by disputes between those leaders over the extent to which Germany should be punished. United States President Woodrow Wilson argued for limited war reparations, thereby encouraging the German people to take the road to democracy. French Premier Georges Clemenceau took the opposing position in an attempt to make sure that Germany would never be able to wage war again. Wilson carried the day, negotiating a moderate treaty that provided for a League of Nations, a precursor to the United Nations. But he ultimately lost out when the United States Senate refused to support him by ratifying the treaty. Historians cite this failure as a major factor in bringing about the rise of Adolf Hitler and a Second World War. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the weighty words flashed over the teletype on December 7, 1941. President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii from the air. Like other radio announcers, WTCN's Roger Krupp did not hesitate to read to his Minneapolis listeners the Associated Press news flash about the attack that plunged the United States into World War II. Krupp's reading of the news flash, however, is traditionally thought to be the first broadcast of the attack. Krupp kept the teletype as a souvenir, and it was recently brought to Sotheby's auction house by a Minneapolis collector who acquired it from Krupp's family following his death in 1987. It is expected to attract up to $5,000 at auction. And two more Civil War era ships have been found and are about to be raised, both in Louisiana and a channel of the Red River. The USS Eastport, an ironclad, ran aground on April 26, 1864, was fired on by Confederate troops, and was blown up by its captain rather than let it fall into Confederate hands. The Ed F. Dix, a 160-foot-long side-wheeled steamer that sunk nearby, was one of the many magnificent steamboats that plied the nation's rivers during the 19th century. This is Talking History. Robert Kennedy, who was born 75 years ago this week, is an American legend. His tragic death in the crisis year of 1968, as one historian has put it, seemed to bring an almost operatic conclusion to the hopes and the idealism of the 1960s. Our guest today, Ronald Steele, has examined the legend of Robert Kennedy in his latest book, In Love with the Night, The American Romance with Robert Kennedy, published by Simon & Schuster. Steele is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. Welcome, Professor Steele.
Thank you.
Why In Love with the Night for your title?
It was a phrase taken from a sonnet by Shakespeare, which he read at the Democratic National Convention in 1964 to introduce a film about his brother. But I thought that the phrase referred also to him and to our fascination with him, in the sense that here was somebody who was, on the one hand, very idealistic, or at least many people felt that he was very idealistic, and on the other hand, who had engaged in all kinds of undercover activities, which, not illegal, but nonetheless, worked the dark side of politics, and that lent something to his character and his persona and to our own fascination with him. So I thought it captured the phrase, which he didn't mean to apply to himself, captures that sense of mystery and even darkness.
describes the area in which he worked, or does it also reflect on his personality?
I think both. I think that when he was a Senate investigator, he often engaged in activities that were very rough, and he was much criticized by civil rights advocates for pushing beyond the limits. And I think this was true also during some of his time as Attorney General when he was investigating Jimmy Hoffa, also during the campaigns that he orchestrated for his brother. He was the tough guy in the administration. He was the one who did the things that, and in the campaign, that his brother didn't want to be blamed for. And they said that. John Kennedy said that himself, that, you know, Bobby does these things, and I just don't want to know about them.
Right.
So I think it worked in his character. He was a mysterious character in many ways. There were so many facets to him, some of which were idealistic, some of which were cynical, some of which were really tough and uncompromising. He was such a complex character that there were many images that people held of him, but this was the counterpart, I thought, to the knight in shining armor image, and this was also an important part of his character.
Well, let me deal with those images a bit, because as I was reading your book and looking at some of the other coverage Kennedy is getting on this anniversary date, I'm reminded of how much people expected of him after his death. In other words, looking at him and saying, if he had lived, he would have won the presidency, ended American involvement in the Vietnam War, brought black and white Americans together, and so on and so forth. How much of this has any basis in reality?
Well, I think it has a great basis in the times. We have to remember that he ran for the presidency in probably the year of the greatest upheaval in American civil life in a very long time. There was the Vietnam War was tearing the country apart. There was the civil rights issue, which was also tearing the cities apart. There was the youth counterculture, which was tearing families apart. And this was a crisis year in American politics. And there was a yearning, of course, understandably, for somebody who would somehow solve these problems, because they were immensely complicated problems. And it isn't that Kennedy said he was going to solve these problems. He addressed them, though, in a way that gave rise to the hopes of very many people that somehow he could cut that Gordian knot, that he could resolve these problems, that he could somehow end the war that was tearing America apart, that he could, being a relatively young person in politics, speak for both his own generation and his parents' generation and the younger generation as well. And also because he had made a special appeal to minorities and particularly to black people, and there was a great deal of trust in him by the black community and by civil rights leaders, not by militants who often didn't trust him at all, but at least by civil rights leaders, that he would somehow bring black and whites together. And it all came to a head in that year in 68. I think that had his assassination occurred and he'd been a politician, let us say, in 1976 or 1980 or so, sometime when there wasn't a crisis in American politics, it would have been less dramatic, it would have been less poignant, there would have been less riding on it. And also he was young, he was attractive, he was articulate, or at least he had very good speechwriters, and he was the heir to a legend very much like his own, of a very attractive man, a president, John Kennedy, who was assassinated before he was ever able to accomplish the great goals that he'd set for himself. And there was this belief that only he had lived, and here was his reincarnation. So I think it was a carrying on of that hope.
Well, that explains the image, but let me just stick with that question a little bit further here. Very briefly, do you think he would have won the presidency?
I don't, and I think most people in the political field seem to share my opinion. We have to remember the primaries weren't so important then as they are today, that the bosses controlled a huge block of delegates, that Hubert Humphrey, who was the handpicked candidate of Lyndon Johnson, had pretty well wrapped it up. I mean, it wasn't a foregone conclusion. I think if Kennedy had won overwhelmingly in California, then there might have been a groundswell of support in that California primary that the bosses couldn't have resisted. But he didn't win by much. He won by a little bit over Gene McCarthy, who was a total upstart and not very well known in the country. And he was actually defeated by McCarthy in the Oregon primary. And that combined with the fact that while there were many people who loved and admired Robert Kennedy, there were many who distrusted him terribly and didn't like him. That was particularly true in the South, but it was true in large elements of the population. He was not a beloved figure everywhere. He was a highly contentious figure, and I think that he probably wouldn't have got the nomination. I think, however, if he had got the nomination, I think he probably would have won. Hubert Humphrey came very close to winning, and I think Kennedy might well have done it. I think a lot of Democrats sat out that election because they felt Humphrey was a tool of Lyndon Johnson. So what he would have done if he had won is another issue.
Well, let me reverse that. Yeah. What would he have done if he had lost?
On the three great issues that we had talked about, first the counterculture, I don't think anybody had a handle on that, him any more than anybody else, and he, in fact, was rather suspicious of it, even though he courted some of its leaders. But it did burn itself out, and I think he wouldn't have dramatized the conflict in a way that I think Nixon did. Secondly, on civil rights, I think that the problems were very deep-seated, and we're still living with these problems today. It's a part of our American history. And I think that there might have been the sense that he spoke for minorities in a way, for example, that minority leaders feel that Bill Clinton speaks for them. But I think the civil rights upheaval of the 60s also tended to stabilize itself in the 70s, partly as a result of the legislation that Congress under Johnson's leadership passed in the 60s, and which Kennedy supported. And on the Vietnam War, I think that there's good reason to think that he probably would have accepted the compromise solution that Nixon finally accepted himself in 1972. I think there's good reason to be optimistic on that ground. I think he probably could have ended the war sooner. However, he always said right up to the end that he was not going to turn South Vietnam over to the communists. So I think we can't be sure about that.
Okay. We know more about Robert Kennedy as Attorney General and as presidential candidate. Many are not familiar with his professional life prior to his brother's election. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, the people who felt most negative about Kennedy were those who remembered very well his role as the Senate investigator, as an investigator on the committee, the Senate committee, headed by Joseph McCarthy, and his reputation as a red chaser, in effect, that many of the abuses of that period in the late 50s, mid and late 50s, were, or throughout the 50s, really, because he worked for McCarthy in the early 50s, that these are attached to him, that he was a zealot person in this pursuit of people deemed disloyal or targeted as being disloyal, and that he was a kind of fanatic himself. And that was the part of image of Kennedy's image that the Porters had the most trouble dealing with later. It didn't jibe with the compassionate, caring, loving person that was portrayed in the 60s, who felt for the pain of minorities and poor people and what have you. And during the 60s, there was a considerable effort to play down the role that he had had with McCarthy, and to say that he had left before McCarthy was indulging in his most serious abuses, and that he couldn't be held responsible for any of that. But I'm afraid that wasn't true. And in fact, he was very personally attached to McCarthy. He liked him a lot. His personal friend, he went to his funeral in the Capitol. He went to his funeral in Wisconsin. He was loyal in that sense. You have to give him credit for that. But a lot of people held that against him. So I think he's best known before Attorney General as a Senate investigator, and then and somebody who was very much in the extreme of the kind of emotional anti-communism that took place in the 50s. And then as a single-minded chaser, not only of communists, but of malefactors everywhere. And that included labor, organized labor, abuses in labor, which he called it. And he had a particular hatred of Jimmy Hoffa, who was leader of the Teamsters Union, and maybe he can be viewed as corrupt. And he was widely accused and disliked by organized labor as having led not only this determined and concentrated chase against Hoffa, but having discredited, at least it was felt, organized labor in general. So he came into the attorney generalship with a great deal of distrust from organized labor and from liberals particularly. And it was only, I think, as attorney general when he got involved in civil rights issues because of the marches, civil rights marches, he had to do so. And then afterwards, the assassination of President Kennedy, I think, helped to restructure that image. And so the conservative ardent anti-communist of the 50s then became the caring liberal of the late 60s who ran for president on that platform.
Let me pick up on that assassination note that you just commented on. One gets the impression of the Kennedy family as the Kennedy men kind of queuing up Joe Jr., then John, and so on, and then it becomes Robert's turn because of the assassination of his brother. Is this an accurate perception that Robert would not have moved forward without John's assassination?
Oh, I think so, yes. The father, as is generally well known, was of enormous ambition, first for himself, and when that didn't work out politically, then for his sons. And when the oldest son was killed in battle, John inherited it and chose to pursue it. And I don't think Bobby was always viewed as the helper. I think it never occurred to him that he would have an electoral political career himself. He was never groomed for that. He didn't really have the personality for it. He was brusque and short-tempered and had very little charm and was a tough bulldog kind of person, a good campaign manager. And it was only JFK's assassination and the enormous public grief that occurred afterwards, a sense of expectations, the pressures of the family and of the whole Kennedy entourage. We have to remember that Kennedys, being an enormously rich family as well as an ambitious family, had an enormous entourage of people whose political lives were wrapped up with the Kennedys. And then they wanted this reign to continue, not only for personal advantage, but because they believed that Bobby could carry on what John Kennedy had begun. And so I think there was great pressure on him to do so, also enormous resentment that Lyndon Johnson, whom he didn't like, should have become president. And I think that combination of opportunity, expectation, and resentment propelled him into politics pretty early. He actually, it was interesting, wanted to be, in 1964, a year after JFK's assassination, he wanted Johnson to name him as his vice presidential candidate, as his running mate in 64. And when Johnson refused to do this, quite understandably, it was only then that he saw a separate political career running for Senate in New York, which then became a springboard, obviously, to his run for the presidency, a phenomenon that we see perhaps reenacted today with Hillary Clinton.
Well, we only have a couple seconds left. Let me just ask you to give me a very brief response to the idea of an assassin's bullet making a hero out of people who maybe wouldn't have become heroes if they had lived. How would you comment on that in terms of Robert Kennedy?
Well, I think that when a young, attractive, articulate person is assassinated at the height of his powers before he has assumed the roles and the responsibilities and the compromises of office, and there's great expectations riding on him, there's naturally the assumption he would have done all these things. And I think it's true of all of us in life that the expectations of our youth are often not fulfilled. I think he would have disappointed a lot of people. I think he would have had views that didn't accord with those of many of his supporters. I think that he would, like all presidents, I think, have had a successes and failures, and perhaps I'm probably a mixed record. But we'll never know, because he'll be forever young and forever the future that we didn't quite have.
Oh, well put. But we'll have to end on that note. So thank you, Professor Steele, for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ronald Steele, author of In Love with Night, The American Romance with Robert Kennedy. Continuing to mark the 75th anniversary of his birth, for our site of the week, we've selected a permanent museum exhibit on Robert Kennedy. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In the museum at the John Fitzgerald Kennedy Library in Boston, Massachusetts, is a Robert F. Kennedy exhibit that outlines the special relationship RFK had with his brother and his role as Attorney General in JFK's administration. The Robert Kennedy Attorney General exhibit has been redesigned and includes more of RFK's accomplishments, as well as more items that were a part of his office at the White House, including sculptures of FDR and Winston Churchill, items presented during travels to Europe and Asia, and awards that he received. On the walls, visitors will find a timeline of significant achievements while he was at Justice, his law degree, and other certificates, along with photographs of RFK at work and with his family, and copies of artwork by his children that were displayed in his office. For more information about the exhibits, you can contact the John Fitzgerald Kennedy Library.
I'll be sitting in the car, watching the ships go in.
Violence brought an end to Robert Kennedy's life, but unfortunately acts of violence are not infrequent or isolated events. Mark Juergensmeyer has studied violence in the world, and in our op-ed of the week he tells us what he has learned about it. Juergensmeyer is the Director of Global and International Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author of Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence.
Why do religious people do violent things? This is the question I sought to answer in my recent book on religious terrorism. I interviewed people associated with some of the most vicious public acts of the contemporary age, from abortion clinic bombings to the unleashing of nerve gas in Tokyo subways. The answer, I found, is in the peculiar mix of politics and religion that has emerged in the global society of the post-Cold War age. In a prison interview, a Muslim activist convicted of bombing the World Trade Center told me that there was a war going on, a war that most Americans never see, he said. Assaults on such public buildings as the World Trade Center and the Oklahoma City Federal Building showed to everyone that, as he put it, the government is the enemy. This point of view was shared by almost all religious activists I interviewed. They felt persecuted. They imagined that their oppression was a part of a cosmic war, an invisible war that most people never see. But in their minds, all of world history was caught up in this great struggle between truth and falsehood. This is an essential religious idea, the war between good and evil, darkness and light. Within the histories of all religious traditions, violence lurks as a shadowy presence. From biblical wars to crusading ventures and great acts of martyrdom, images of death have never been far from the heart of religion's power to stir the imagination. But in recent years, this religious violence has surfaced in more than symbolic ways. Religious violence has reappeared in a form calculated to terrify on a massive scale. Cosmic wars had become real. Political enemies are seen as satanic foes. When a government, such as the United States, is perceived as a satanic enemy, it has to be cautious. It has to avoid responding like an enemy. Countering acts of terrorism with terrorism may be instinctive, but it might also promote the idea of cosmic war and invite even more violence in response. Eventually, religious violence has to be countered on a religious plane. Its perpetrators have to see that their battles can be waged through a form of struggle that is symbolic and nonviolent. Perhaps they will also find what religious people have found throughout the ages, that the inner struggle is ultimately more purifying, more satisfying, and just.
You've been listening to Mark Juergensmeyer, author of Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence. This is Talking History. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we have a series of History Channel programs to call to your attention. On November 20th, watch for the Wright Brothers Controversy. Most people assume that Orville and Wilbur Wright were the first to fly an airplane, but other aviation pioneers flew around the same time. Tune in and see who was actually first. On November 21st, the History Channel will air another segment of The Real West, this time looking at the Stagecoach and the Pony Express, both of which forged transportation and communication links between the American East and West. On November 23rd, look for the caveman and get caught up on the latest research on those early humans that roamed the Earth some 70,000 years ago. While on November 25th, the History Channel will air How Did They Build That?, a two-hour program devoted to examining the design and construction of some of history's most awe-inspiring structures. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will look at the history and meaning of Plymouth Rock, just in time for Thanksgiving. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. For a world of attack in the sea, if we're everywhere, don't wanna be free. Let them be and listen, that's the answer.